Accession number 8834, rule number 5.
Mr. Northcote, tape 5. You were saying that you had this very heavy equipment
terrific
and you had
load.
To come down this
terrific load. You wanted
ladder.
Both hands to tell us how hang on. Pitch dark, of course, and when you got down to the bottom, you stepped onto the gunwale of a trawler. She was alongside. And a couple of seamen there helped you down with all that load on, because you had to step down, probably the gunwale of the ship's about that high, step down with all this load on. Well, I mean, it's all in a day's work. And then we went in from the, of course the ship was a fair distance out to keep in deep water, big ship, and we went in on the trawler to the pontoons where landed on the pontoons and walked ashore.
So you didn't actually have to go through the River Clyde, you just went
on
the pontoons?
Oh no, you couldn't go through the Clyde. No, you were alongside her. They were fastened to the Clyde and fastened to the shore. Of course, they'd been able to sort of dolly things up by in the 6 days. The engineers had been at work tying everything securely. And then we got onto the shore, and there was a ridge, and we marched from there up to the where the graves are now, where they on the side of a hill, and we slept the night there, just bedded down, piled your rifle, lay down, and went to sleep the next morning.
What did you think when you woke up the next morning and you were actually on Gallipoli? What did it all look like to you?
Nothing very much, really. It was just another day.
What
and then
the
we did go in. We dug. The first thing we did was we had to dig what they call anti-shell things. They're not a trench. You dig a square, and you pile the earth outside, all four sides, and then get in about probably 8 or 9 of you inside. And the next one's there. So if a shell lands in one, it'll wipe that lot out. The splinters will miss the other. So that was that. We're in there for the day. Then towards evening, we marched along down back towards V Beach, bit inland, and we dug slip trenches just to get in for the night. And you couldn't sit down, you couldn't lie down, you could probably sit down, but about as deep as the top of this mantelpiece.
About 6 foot?
Oh, a little less. And
no, it's about
we finished
four,
digging, and my brother, as I told you, was my sergeant, my cousin, why, I don't know, because he lay down in the bottom. And my brother said, you can't sleep there. We called him Brown, didn't call him Harold. He said, Brown, you can't sleep in there, you know, other people have got to come in. And he took umbrage at this, got out and lay down, wouldn't come back in. He lay out all night, and there's stray fire the whole time there. Bullets coming over, almost spent. And one went into his right thigh there. Completely buried, but didn't touch the bone. Anyway, it was quite painful, I suppose, and they called a stretcher up, and the stretcher didn't know which way to go, so he said, oh, Northcote, platoon commander, he says, Northcote, take your cousin down. I think he can hobble. So he put his arm, he said, take your rifle and that yourself. He left all this stuff there. I said, oh, I know the way, about half a mile or so. down to the dressing station. The dressing station is just a pile of sandbags with a tin roof on the top.
Whereabouts was that? Down on the beach?
Yes, down on the beach, right, just above the beach. I was in there myself later. And anyway, I took him down there. He put his arm round my neck and I put my arm round his waist, put the rifle over the shoulder, and he'd hobble down with me on one, more or less on one leg, on his left leg. And I said, cheerio, left him there and back. And that was about 4, 5 o'clock in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning. Then we spent the night there, and then in the morning we moved over about another quarter of a mile to the right into another slit trench, and an attack was taking place, and we had a battery of artillery, one of our batteries, 15 inch guns, and a battery of the French 75, famous 75 gun, and the ammunition dump was a little way away, and I was doing it myself with a lot of others, carrying two shells, one on each shoulder, up to these guns, feeding the guns. Well, that lasted for a little while, and then that packed up.
Had you any idea what that attack was about, Tom? You know, where?
Yes, gain extra ground, get near the Turks. I mean, nearly all.
Yes, they were attempting to advance at this stage,
yeah,
were they?
We were trying to capture Akihabara and join up with the Australians. The Australians couldn't move, they were bogged down. Landed in the wrong place, the wrong beach.
How about Akihabara? You know, was it a very dominant feature?
Yes, it was a
dominant
feature, not all that high, it was about 900 feet. But it was a dominant feature because it's. Slopes ran down to the sea on all sides, and of course there were two big gullies, ravines, coming down, and when it rained, the main ravine, used to rise to 20 feet anyway, water, bodies floating, horse bodies, all sorts of stuff floating down, out into the sea. I think they entered the sea near Saddle Bar and went into the Dardanelles itself. That is the Dardanelles, the water there, as far as the Narrows.
This attack, you know, that you carried the shells up for, this little operation, what was the result of that? Had you any idea?
They gained a bit of ground, and that night we went up, and we went up Indian file. We had somebody, it was pitch black, raining dreadful, and it was about 2 or 3 miles, about 3 miles but, and in Indian file one fellow went down a well. His equipment and his arms stopped him. We had to lug him out, and when we got him out, of course the other people had gone. And anyway, somebody came, realised what had happened, came back and linked up with us. Couldn't see anything. And we got up to the line, and the trenches, they dug a trench, but it wasn't very deep. Earth thrown out for a parapet. Johnny Turk knew there was something out, he knew there was some movement, troops going on, so he decided to have a bang, so he opened up with all the gunfire they had, you know, rifle fire, and we lost quite a few men. There was a man next to me who was killed, he was shot through the head, an awful nice chap called Tom Penny, father of the printing works in Stockport, and a great friend from our tent, Jack Thomas, he was hit by a bullet right through the neck, in one side and out the other. And the doctor told him, he said, well, if I'd tried to put a surgical instrument through there, he said, I'd have killed you. Amazing thing.
He survived that, obviously.
Oh, God, yes. Saw quite a bit of him when I was down here. He went to live when he retired.
This front line you went to, you know, that you moved up to, how near the Turks would you have been then?
We were I know, because I did my sniping from there. 600 yards. We're still 600 yards.
And you consolidated that line, did you, and stayed there? Am I right?
Well, we consolidated the trenches, you see.
Yes.
Digging all night.
Well, was it difficult terrain, you know, to dig in?
Oh, well, it's everything was inches in mud. Terrible.
Was it very wet at that time, then?
Well, it was raining like smoke. It had started raining in the late afternoon. It kept on all night. Never stopped. Awful conditions. Well, I mean, it's what they went through, the poor devils in France went through for months and months on end on duck boards and all that sort of thing. Duck boards.
Yes, it's a good comparison, isn't it? But were your trenches waterlogged? You know, once you dug them, did you find you had water in your trenches?
Oh, when it rained, it was water. Nothing you could do, couldn't do anything about it. Was the morning after we landed.
Oh, now you're going back. Yes, the morning after we landed. You're telling us an anecdote.
But it's rather a funny one. You'll see why in a minute. Company Sergeant Major came up and said, Grimshaw and Tom, they said, go up, we want you to go out and look in all the trees, any big trees. We've got a message through that there's Turkish snipers lying about in these trees. You can't hardly see them. They're lying on the branches. In some cases, they're tied to the branches and they're picking off officers. Whether it was true or not, I can't say. Go out and see if you can find anything. He says, go along the coast, you know, as far as you think necessary. And come back at dusk, you know, before it gets dark. So off we toddled, and we're looking up in these trees, you know, this only tree, wondering whether we would get shot before this, so we could get a shot at him. Never saw a darn thing. But we got behind the Senegalese lines, where the Senegalese were, and they were just going to make an attack, and the rifle fire was coming over because they knew the Turks were firing at them, and they were telling us to get down. There was a French officer, you know, the French sergeants and officers, get down, anyway. Just behind there was a field kitchen and three European French chaps in big hefty blokes. They were cooks. And they got this thing was full of cream potato soup and onions. God. So we went on, bonjour, monsieur, you know, a bit pidgin French. And soup, we have some soup, you see. And well, we got our mess tins out and gave us a good old ladle of this soup. It was delicious. We'd got to eat. We had to take it. If you went out anywhere like that, and a tin of bully beer, and there were three or four army biscuits. Couldn't break them hardly. Couldn't bite them. Now anyway, we said. I said to Grimmy, "Let's give him a tin of our bully. We don't want two tins." We gave him the tin of bully, and he nearly went frantic. He still knew what it was. Oh, couldn't read. I don't suppose he could read what was on it. I think it was Frey Bentos or something like that. And, oh, good. Oh, merci beaucoup, you know. Shaking hands all around. And we carried on, and we went on towards this, city. Oh, what's the name of the place again? I've been telling all the time. Just packing my memory again. One of the beaches where the Senegalese landed, and there's a battery there. It was down in a hollow with an enormous thick stone wall about higher than this ceiling, and two enormous guns. The German, all the stuff was German, and they were on a big carriage with iron staircase on each side, and they were ran on lines set into the concrete, and they could do it by turning wheels, you know, move it that way, and they could, with another wheel, they could elevate or depress the gun barrel. Oh, they must have been about anything up to 12 inches, enormous things. And they'd been hit by the Navy, both of them out of action. One over almost on its side, the other one was pointing up to heaven. Anyway, we didn't go in there because we thought, you never know. It's not our job to go. We've seen what we want to see. It was very interesting to see.
Did you get any Turkish snipers, though, when you went
out? No, I was sniping in the front line only afterwards. A lot, a tremendous lot of sniping.
Mm. They were good, were they, the Turkish snipers?
Well, there was one in particular. He had a telescopic sight. Well, it might have been a German for all we know. There was German officers leading them.
Did you see evidence of that yourself? Did you see...
Oh, my brother saw nearly... He ran in the big attack the week after I was wounded. I'd have been killed in that, certain. He fired his 10 rounds and didn't realise he'd been hit through the arm there. Went to reload his rifle and a great big ball of blood fell out of his hand. Been running down his arm into his hand. And... he decided enough was enough, he's just going to reload to get a pot shot. A very senior German officer, very Maradadi uniform. One in command, it was all German lad.
How long were you actually in those trenches altogether?
Three weeks.
What was your life like during those 3 weeks? You know, what your daily routine, what would it have been?
Pretty rough. I did the cooking for our little lot, our section, as usual. No water at all. We dug a hole in the back of the trench and sank an old empty biscuit tin. They were big tins, about like 4 gallon, what we call debbies in East Africa, like this, they had the kerosene in, and we put holes in with a bayonet through the side, and the water percolated in from the ground. And it was the colour of tea before we used it. You didn't have touched it without boiling it, but all we did was boil it. And I had a lot, my brother, before he went up to the line, he had a big, one of these big wooden boxes of tea and sugar mixed. Anybody want any of this tea and sugar? I said, yes, I will. And we had the bag you carried your helmet in, canvas bag. And I filled that thing out about 5 or 6 pounds of tea and sugar. We were never short. We always had it.
Did they not bring you water up at the front line?
No,
we
got
nothing.
Never had a drop of water. Your water bottles were full, and orders were never touch a water bottle unless dire necessity.
So what would have happened if you hadn't had this device, this means of getting water?
Well, you'd have had to find it somewhere. That's the way we found it. And we had a piece of stick and an empty little jam tin, I think it had been, and we tied that to it and used it as a dipper. And all of that. We had a piece of something we used to put over a board or something. We put over the top of it to stop people kicking the dirt in from the trench. That's an absolute fact. It sounds incredible, but it is. I never had a drop of water from leaving the Derfflinger until I got on the ship to go to Malta, where I ruined it. 4 weeks, never had a drop of cold, ordinary water.
So how about washing? Is it a ridiculous question?
You didn't wash, you didn't shave. You looked like the old man from the sea. No, you never wash. The only, I'm telling a lie there, I went down once to the gully and there was a stream running down, just not very much water, it hadn't been raining a lot. And I had a cake, I'd taken a cake of Lifebuoy soap. I swear by Lifebuoy soap now, I use it now for hands and that. And I washed all over and I never got any lice. We went down, when we came out of the trenches after 10 days, we went down to X Beach, I think it was, and I had a bathing parade. Of course, nobody had anything to wear, no costumes, briefs. You just had a towel, and you went in your birthday suit. And I'm stating a fact, my brother even, they were all looking for lice in their clothes. I hadn't got a thing on. Peeling simply through washing with Lifebuoy soap. And good advert for the
yes, I was thinking you're for Lieber Brothers. Aren't you?
Anyway, we had a jolly good old dip. And we did that with 2 days out, we did that 2 days running. But the scum on the water, there's no tide there in the Aegean. There's no tide at all. And the scum about for about 4 feet out, straw, old bits of wood, or you name it, it was rubbish all along the shore. Fortunately, I was quite a good swimmer, and I went out and had a little tiny jetty where the pinnaces used to come. I went out and dived at the end of there. Got a good old swim.
Were you quite safe from the Turks there, or could they strike at you?
Yes. Well, as safe as you could be. You couldn't be safer there. Because they weren't firing in that direction, as a rule. They were firing straight down the peninsula. We were on the side, on the northern side, facing Greece, in other words. And when we came off the bathing parade, we found out there was a Greek used to come over in a sailing boat from Greece, and he had a little hut down on the shore there. And he used to come over with eggs, oranges, chocolate, cigarettes, stuff like that. And we went down, and Horace said, well, if you're going down there, get a dozen eggs for us, for the sergeants. And we got a dozen for ourselves, and we carried them in our helmets, you know, carried them by the strap. we got back to where they were supposed to be resting. We were up to here and found they'd moved. Oh God, going to be shot for deserters. Anyway, we found them, and we fried up the eggs in our mess tin lid. When you take the lid off, there's a handle, and you can pull it out, and that's a frying pan. Turns upside down, that's actually a frying pan.
What other food did you have? You've mentioned the bully beef and the
luxury of eggs. Bully beef. What I used to do, I was a egg cook and bottle washer. We used to cut across in the parados, that's the back of the trench. It's lower than the trench itself, and find any bits of wood we could, light up the fire, fill the mess tins with this water out of the thing, the 12 mess tins, and you put 4 at the bottom, then another 4, and then another 4, make a funnel. When the bottom 4 were boiling, dismantle the whole thing and start again with the top ones at the bottom. When it was all boiled up, you threw in, we had the only thing that was very good, we had tins of shredded dry vegetables, and we used to put a couple of handfuls of that in, shred up some bully, and it was jolly nice. I never felt so well in my life.
Is that so? You kept quite well, did you?
Fit as a fiddle, because I pushed the bus over.
Were you exceptional, or were you all like that?
No, we were all the same. It's a jolly good tack, I'll tell you. We had that 3 times a day, and we followed it up. You don't use any water to, because it was pretty scarce, even with this tin thing. It came from underground, actually. They were very waterlogged, the trench. We were on fairly low ground. Anyway, what you did, you just scooped out what you could with your finger and flicked it off, and then filled up with water again, And when it's boiling, bung in your tea and sugar mix. No milk, of course. Well, it's all a good tack.
And did you have much fire from the Turks? You know, sort of enfilade?
No. The thing was to keep shut up. If you were not going to attack or do anything, or saw something, you didn't fire at all. Nobody was allowed to fire without orders, except Grimshaw and myself as snipers.
And how did you? What sort of activity did you do as snipers?
My brother had his telescope, 600 yards, you couldn't see. And we got it all logged out. But there's no trick in the army of two fingers or three fingers or one finger, right or left. And when you put them up like that, you've got the measurement. Say you've got a bush, two fingers right of the bush, two fingers left of the bush, three fingers left of the bush. And it was very, 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 very good. And we could shoot, I'll tell you. Give me a lie. Apart from being extremely fit. And we could plant, I know we tried it out, get the two shots in the palm of your hand at 600 yards.
And did you
when. This sniper, he did off a lot of damage. When he started, well, we could shut him up anyway. He made it so damn uncomfortable that he packed it up. And of course, I'm supposed to have got three one morning. I don't know. I don't like talking about that because, although it's war, and there you are. Yes, that's right.
Yes, or do tell us about that, Mr. Northcote.
Well, I don't like to say.
Well, it's very interesting information.
Well, it's my brother. He was looking at the telescope, and I mean, he saw them go. You see the hands up in there and drop.
Did you get any sort of recognition for that?
No. I was told the first time I'd seen him, our colonel was taken sick in Cairo. Colonel Haywood, very nice man, and was invalided home with eye trouble from the glare of the sun. He was a fair age. And my old company commander was Captain Worthington. When I'm going back a bit away now, our brigadier was Noel Lee.
Noel
Lee, NOELLW. And Noel Lee, the Lees, were the firm, you know, the Tootle firms, the big cotton firm, Tootle Broadus Lee. And Lee was one of their family. They were very wealthy people.
Did you ever see these sort of high-ranking officers?
Colonel Lee, yes. He presented with me when I won all those prizes as a recruit. He was the colonel of our battalion. He presented me with them. Oh, yes, he knew us.
We were
well known, being shot, brother and I, being, you know, Bisley shot. We were pretty well known in the battalion. Noel Lee, he became, the year after I joined, I don't know what happened to the brigadier. The brigadier is the head of the division, brigadier general. And he was made brigadier general, and our Captain Worthing, from our company, was made colonel. Was made major, second in command. And Haywood, the colonel that came home invalid, he was made colonel. Of course, so Colonel Haywood came home. Major Worthington was not promoted to colonel, but he was acting colonel in command of the battalion. And with him we had all territorial battalions had a regular army adjutant. Ours was a Captain Hoburn, one of the finest men I've ever met. Marvellous man.